lecture. It's been fun trying to thinking of subjects to cover. There's a fair number of subjects I didn't cover. So I have a few regrets, and of course I'm going to mention all of them explicitly. I didn't cover Gleason's theorem. This is one of the, I think, important theorems in quantum foundations. Sort of stands alongside the Koch and Specker, the PBR, and Bell's theorem. It shows that you can recover if your measurements correspond to projection operators, you can recover that your states must correspond to density matrices with some assumptions. In its original version, it's a very difficult theorem. There's some simplified versions due to Paul Bush and Chris Fuchs and collaborators using, rather than projection valued operators, more general positive operators. So that's an important theorem I didn't cover. I didn't really talk much about Bell's theorem. Of course, Joe Emerson covered that in his courses, so it wasn't strictly necessary, but there's a lot of interesting material here. Obviously very central to quantum foundations. I didn't talk about cubism or the Copenhagen interpretation. I think cubism is sort of the modern descendant of the Copenhagen interpretation. So this is due to Chris Fuchs and his collaborators, so Rudiger Schack and Carl Caves in particular, recently David Mermin. One of the reasons I didn't cover this is I didn't really feel capable of giving a proper summary of the ideas here. But Chris has given lots of lectures which are available on Pursa, so that would be a good place to go if you want to find out more. You did the ABL formula in the tutorials, but one thing we didn't do was weak measurements. There's a really interesting development due to Haranov and his co-workers. If you weakly measure a system, you get all these odd sort of paradoxical results. It's a very interesting area of quantum foundations. I didn't cover Popescu-Rolik boxes. These are sort of sometimes called non-local boxes. These are this is an idea to have some sort of system. It's not really physical. You can't make this in practice, but they violate Bell's inequality by the maximum amount. So rather than they violate it more than quantum theory does. They're sort of as non-local as they can be without actually permitting the possibility of sending signals.
So what stands for PR?
Popescu and Rolik. Rolik. Popescu and I think that's the spelling, or something like that. Relatedly, I didn't do the Torsen bound. You can show that the maximum possible violation of a Bell inequality in quantum theory is 2√2. So this is sort of the quantum counterpart to Bell's theorem, where the maximum violation the maximum amount you can get for the Bell argument is 2 in a local hidden variable theory. Sorkin has this interesting measure theory. Where he shows that you have a hierarchy of possible sort of interference effects. So if you start with a classical case, then you know in the classical case the interference pattern you get at the back is really just the sum, the classical sum of the two probability distributions. In quantum theory, you start to get interference, but it's interesting that in quantum theory, all the interference is essentially just is already captured in two slits. If you go to three slits, then you can think of the pattern at the back as corresponding to the interference you see through pairs of slits plus a classical sum from the remaining slit. So he has this hierarchy of possible interference measures that depend on three slits and then four slits and so on. So classical and quantum are the first two examples. And of course, there's many more subjects in quantum foundations. It's a very old subject. It goes back to at least 1927. People have been thinking about the foundations of quantum theory for a very long time. Yeah, so there's many subjects I didn't cover, and I think if you want to pursue an interest in the field, these things in particular are worth looking at. So in this last lecture, I'm going to cover just a few topics. If I don't finish, yep. Torsen. Yeah.
Is that got different spelling?
Yeah, I think there's very well, I may have even got that may even be wrong, but there are various spellings in the literature of this guy's name.
Yeah.
I think it's transcribed from Russian in different ways. Sometimes there's an S in there somewhere,
like
or
E as well.
Yeah, I may have spelled it completely wrong there, I'm not sure.
The Wikipedia says TSIRELSLM.
T R. Yeah, actually, sorry. So that clearly is wrong. Okay, good. Sorosan, yeah. Sorry about that. I'm going to talk about maybe three or four subjects today. I'm going to start off sort of motivated by the previous lecture. An interesting subject is think about the shape of the space of quantum states. So here I'm thinking about the space of general mixed states, not just the pure states. So what can we say from what we know already about this, the shape of this space? Well, we know it has k equals n squared dimensions, where n is the dimension of the Hilbert space. So we know that we get this is the dimension of the space. It's a convex set. It's a convex set in this dimension. Of this dimension. What else do we know? Well, the normalized states have dimension k a minus 1. Now, if we take the boundary of the normalized states, that has dimension k minus 2, because the boundary is always just one less, dimension one less. I guess to be consistent with previous lecture, I should be doing these subscripts in blue. I'm going to save myself that trouble today. What else do we know? Well, we know from quantum theory that the pure states, which are the extremal, in the convex set, the number of real parameters is L equals, so this is the dimension of the pure states. The reason for that is that you can write a pure state like that, but we have to subtract. So here we have 2n real parameters, because we have n complex numbers, so 2n real parameters. But we have to subtract one because of overall normalization, and subtract another one because of, sorry, subtract one because of the overall phase, and subtract another one because of normalization. We also know that there's pure states live in it's a continuous and closed space. So you don't come to the edge of the pure state space, and also you can go from any pure state to any other one by a continuous transformation. So the whole space is continuous. There's not different. There's not discrete parts. Different parts of it. So how does this work out in practice? Well, consider the special case n equals 2. Well, then we have the dimension of the boundary is equal to n squared minus 2 equals 2. And the dimension of the pure state space is 2n minus 2 equals 2. Okay, so in this case, they coincide. And in fact, we knew that already, because this is just a special case where you have the block ball. Which is sitting inside here. And you can see the boundary has dimension 2. And all the states on the surface of this block ball are extremal. So the pure states have dimension 2. Because it's a ball. Any questions? Okay. But what about n is greater than 2? Then we have the boundary dimension is always greater than 2n minus 2, which is the dimension of the set of pure states. And this is obvious. This grows as n squared. And this grows as n. So it's interesting that the case we think about most often, this case of a qubit, is actually rather special. It's the only case where the pure states, where all the states on the boundary are pure states. Any questions?
Yes. So when we first introduced the idea of this convex set of state space, I thought we said that the pure states were precisely the ones that were on the boundary, were on a non-flat part of the boundary.
Exactly, yeah.
So does this say that?
This means there are flat parts to the boundary. Surprise.
But in general, there are flat parts to the boundary. So these are actually just going to be states that you can write as, like, if you take some basis, any basis, and then you take mixed states. In that basis, you could actually correspond to more than just two terms. So you have states which contain n minus one terms. Maybe I should write that down differently. So states like this. So we take a set that's missing one, or at least one, of the integers from 1 to n. And then we form a mixed state by summing over these terms. And the sum of lambdas are positive. And they sum to 1. Then these states will actually be on the boundary.
So
what you'll have is inappropriate coordinates. You'll have a higher dimensional sphere, but not all the points on that sphere will correspond to pure states or states at all.
Right. So because when you say that there are parts of the boundary that flat, that means that I have mixed states on the boundary. While for the higher dimensional Fock sphere, I feel as that you have things on the boundary that aren't even states.
No, but that
the other way.
Well, the right way to think about it is, so we're interested in the boundary of the states. So the boundary of the states, so the space or the convex set of states will lie inside a sphere,
right.
Or it may be a distorted sphere if you're in the wrong coordinates. But its boundary won't everywhere touch that sphere. And it'll be flat in places.
So at these points, would you say they're supremums then of the set rather than like being natural maximum?
I'm not sure if I understand. Maybe I'll say a few more things and then we can address this question again, because there's a few more things to write down and then it'll come back to this. It'll become clearer. So I can't really draw a good example of this. Like the next example where n is equal to 3, then we have n squared the space of states is then in n squared, normalized states is in n squared minus one, so that's eight dimensional. So I can't really hope to draw that. Here's the best example I can think of something that has these kinds of properties. Something that has properties like this. If you take a circle, a ring, and then you just gently bend it, okay? So I'll try and draw that. So I'm not sure this is a very good drawing. I meant to bring a ring. If you just take a circle and then gently bend it, okay. So now you have on the circle, you have a continuous set of extremal points. And now you can complete this into a convex set. I'll use a different color chalk. Just by you take the convex completion of this. So all these okay, is that picture clear? You can probably do a better job yourselves. So now the surface is flat everywhere except on this ring that I bent, and those points are not, it's not flat. So the points on here are extremal, but everywhere else they are it's every other point on the boundary is flat. So these are so that's sort of the best thing I can draw that captures some of this. But we can say a bit more if we think about the nature of this space. So what I'm going to say here is adapted for my purposes from a paper by Appleby Erickson. And Fuchs, Chris Fuchs. So the idea is to try and characterize mathematically the pure states, because if you know the pure states of a convex set, then by finding the convex hull of that set of pure states, you can find the whole set of states. So a convex set is characterized by its pure states, by its extremal states. So one test for purity, it's necessary and sufficient, is a state is pure if that is true. Remember, we can convert a density matrix into a list of probabilities. That's what we were doing in previous lectures. I've gone back to using p's to represent probabilities. So if we plug, and we know that there's a linear relationship between this and this. So what that implies is that this equation here, if we plug under that linear relationship in here, we're going to get that each of the pk's, each entry of this, is given by some quadratic function of the of all the probabilities. Is that clear? If you take the product of a matrix like that, you're just getting a quadratic function. And the problem here is that we have n squared equations. So it's not very useful for understanding the shape of this space. But there's a better way of doing things in that paper. So it turns out there's a theorem this is due to so in a paper, you can find that paper on the archive. It says a state is pure if and only if this is a truly remarkable result. For two reasons. First reason, it captures, it gives you a condition on the pure states with only two equations, rather than one that scales as the square of the dimension of the space. And secondly, because it was discovered in 2004, it's such a simple condition. And yet, so Chris Fuchs asked around, and as far as he could tell, nobody knew about this earlier. Yeah, trace of rho squared was known, but this is the remarkable thing, yeah. Trace of rho cubed.
And why isn't it sufficient to just have trace of rho
squared? Well, so suddenly, trace of rho squared already follows from that one. But it, all that does is it captures a big sphere in appropriate coordinates, a reparametrized sphere. But we know that some parts of the state space are flat, so the sphere can't be sufficient. So what you have, I'll come back to this in a minute. I'll continue. I'll write down, you'll see it's not sufficient. So this result appeared somewhere in this paper. I looked at this paper this morning, and I couldn't find the result there. It wasn't the main point of that paper. So it's reasonable to say that Chris Fuchs rescued this result from obscurity. Sort of rescued. And what it implies is that a state is pure if a certain quadratic function of the probabilities is equal to 1 and a certain cubic function. Those probabilities is equal to 1. So just two equations. So now with this in place, you can see that you can think of the pure states as corresponding to the intersection of a quadratic equation, which basically defines a sphere. If you find the right coordinates, it's a sphere, and some cubic equation. And I think if one could get a deeper understanding of what was going on here, there may be some deep insight into the nature of the quantum state space. I can't provide you with that deeper insight, although you can look at Chris's papers. He has some ideas. It's worth comparing this with the classical case. So remember, the classical space is like this. And the pure states are just the ones that appear on these axes. At the 1 mark. And they satisfy 2 equations. So one way to pick out these, in this case, three points is to say, or in general to say, well, the sum of the probabilities is 1. And then, but that doesn't, that just gives us this whole surface. If you want to just get the pure states, one way to do that is to say that also the sphere, which is given by a quadratic equation, I'm not sure, the sum sphere, I'll write it down as a quadratic equation. Equal to 1. So if you can imagine the sphere that passes, a square that passes through those points, that will give you a quadratic equation. So you have now 2 equations. In this case, you have 1 linear and 1 quadratic. In this case, you have 1 quadratic and 1 cubic. And once again, maybe there's a hierarchy. I suggested calling this the Fuchs hierarchy, and Chris didn't like it. But anyway, I'm going to ascribe it to him. Call that the Fuchs hierarchy. Now it's official because this is a Psi lecture course. So I think there's some interesting things to be explored here. But that's all I can think of to say. If I don't finish the 2 remaining topics, or 3 remaining topics, I'll have to add a few extra things to this list, but let's persist. Did I answer your questions now about this? Is that now clear? So you have the intersection of a quadratic and a cubic equation. So clearly not all the states on the surface, on the sphere itself, would correspond to pure states.
So on the, let's say for a Q-trit, having the surface of this, maybe I just understood it incorrectly in words, but I was under the impression that you had things that were on the surface that weren't even physical states.
That's right. Yeah, well, there's two surfaces we're talking about here.
Yeah, so I'm talking about the actual sphere.
So there's the surface of the sphere, okay? But then there's also the surface of the physical state space. So the physical state space is going to be inside here.
Yeah.
It'll be flat everywhere. It doesn't. I can't draw it really because I need more dimensions. But mm-hmm. it'll be flat everywhere. It doesn't touch the. This is not a good representation because it's got discrete parts. Everywhere it doesn't touch the surface of the sphere, it'll be flat. And it's the intersection of this sphere with that cubic equation that gives you these bits.
Yeah. So not the state space surface, but the sphere yeah. surface. Every physical state on the sphere surface is going to be a pure state.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
No,
so that was the question.
So do the flat parts kind of pick out some special basis? Because I mean, if you're inside the block sphere, you can draw a line through any mixed state in an arbitrary direction. But if you had a flat surface. Mm-hmm. You couldn't draw that line normal to the surface, right? To decompose your state.
I think within each surface
is going to correspond to a quantum system of dimension one less than the one under consideration, and so there's no particular basis picked out, except one basis state is excluded, I guess, yeah, that's the best intuition I can give you. My intuition isn't very strong for this space in general. I think more work needs to be done. Okay. How much time do I have? So I'm going to just, rather than go into any detail, I'm going to quickly talk about a particular reformulation of quantum theory. It relates to the work that we've already done. So remember, we had, let's use the same example. We had this circuit. So this circuit is described in symbolic language like this. Oh, and I should have used blue. What about that? I saw some blue chalk. So I'm just going to circle that in blue. That should be in blue. So the probability of this is given by an expression that looks exactly the same, except now we've converted blue to white chalk. And so now we have tensors. And this is for general probabilistic theories. Quantum theory fits into this framework, as does classical probability theory and potentially other probability theories. So this is very general. But what if we're interested in quantum theory in particular? Then these objects, although we can work out what they are, they're not exactly tailored for quantum theory. It's difficult to know what the constraints are on the space of states and the space of transformations and results or effects. These are effects. So it's difficult to know what the constraints are. But it turns out that we can do something different. We can write this we can write this down as an expression involving operators. And these operators are Hermitian operators that act on a certain Hilbert space, which I'll explain. And there's a linear map from any one of these elements, any one of these, to any one of these. So there's a linear map. Let's just do it there. So if you know this tensor, in any case, it's possible to find the operator tensor. So I need to explain what these objects are. These objects are, let's take one example. So this is an Hermitian operator on a Hilbert space like this. The Hilbert space dimension is determined by the type of system it corresponds to. Okay.
Would we say that these are dual spaces?
Yeah, you would say these are dual spaces. Yeah. I mean, it's a bit subtle because we're really interested in the space of Hermitian operators. And we're working in finite dimensional quantum theory here, so we don't have to worry about how to set up the dual space, especially. So what I haven't told you what this expression means. See, over here, when we have a repeated index, that means we're summing. We have the Einstein summation convention. So down here, and remember up here, we can mix these, we can reorder these big letters in any way we want. It doesn't matter what order they appear in. So that's true. That's going to be true down here. So we have to understand this kind of expression in a slightly different way from normal. These subscripts and superscripts are playing a big role. So just to explain what's going on here, just a few examples. If we have A1, B2, then that's an operator acting on a Hilbert space, which is the tensor product. Use blue. So objects like this are actually tensor products. But I'm not using this tensor product notation because I don't have to because we have separate labels. And if I have something like this, where now I have the same integer, then what this means is, well, see over here, if we have the same label, then we're doing a sum over that label. Over here, we have operators. We want to do something that's like a sum, and the thing that's like a sum is taking the trace. So we multiply these two operators together and take the trace. There's a trace of that. And one more example. If we have something like this, well, here we have a repeated label. So we need to take some trace, but we also have these labels that aren't repeated. So what we want to do is multiply these operators together in the space, in the part of the space corresponding to the C3 label, and then take the partial trace over that Hilbert space. Okay. So basically partial trace. So then this thing has some meaning. And what's nice about going to this representation for quantum theory is that you can now write down the constraints on these operators in a very simple way. So operators that actually correspond to physically realizable situations satisfy two constraints. The first one is this. If you write down the operator in some basis, and then you take the partial transpose, so just the transpose over the output space, so you're transposing the elements of the matrix corresponding to the output part of the space, then the resulting operator has to be positive. And then the other constraint is that if you sum this, so you take the partial trace of the operator with the identity operator on the Hilbert space associated with the output variable, then the thing you get is less than or equal to 1. So this is a kind of normalization. It stops probabilities being greater than 1. And this stops probabilities being less than 0. And so these two constraints are very easily expressed in terms of these operators. Whereas if you were to try and write down the same constraints in terms of these tensors, then it would be a much more complicated constraint. Possible in principle, but it wouldn't look so elegant. Okay. So that was a little quick. Obviously, I wanted to give you an idea of this. Any questions before I move on? Yep.
It's kind of like, I guess, connects between the operator stuff and the space. So like when you have a space of operators, right? Mm-hmm. I often see people write about the code around the identity, and they use this as a kind of a...
code around the identity?
Yeah, it's like a... It's remarks to be the cone...
Normally when people talk about the cone, it's the cone about the origin, so the vertex of the cone is at the origin. You could think of that as corresponding to the null state. Mm-hmm. In the case of a state, it would correspond to... the case where every fiducial property has zero,
and then that induces a cone, and then the cap of the cone are the normalized states, and then the full space of states is useful. Any, I can draw part of it for a block sphere. So if I have a block sphere like this, let me just restrict myself to the states on a great circle, of block sphere. Then that great circle is the cap of a cone. And the bottom of the cone is at the origin where all the probabilities are zero. This is the null state. The center of the block sphere is just here.
Yeah,
which is here.
How does it fit into the block? Like if you were to draw it on, it's like outside of the
block sphere. So because the block sphere, you remember, we have 4 k equals 4, but we impose normalization. We impose z p of z plus minus equals 1 when we drew that sphere inside the cube. So this is the top of the cone. But if we relax this, so we allow this to be less than 1, then we sort of go down this cone until we hit the bottom where this is 0.
So
the question is, why would we consider unnormalized states? And I think I've mentioned a few times during the course of this lecture, I'm an anti-advocate for normalizing states. I think it's a big mistake. But this doesn't have to sum to 1. I'll explain this. So imagine we have a experiment like this. Okay. We can even think we have a button on here that we press. But this box may have some lights on it that flash, may have some outcomes associated with it. There's no reason to restrict outcomes only to measurement devices. They can also happen on preparation devices. And actually, this is very typical. Preparation, typically, you have, even when you initiate it, you only have some probability of successfully preparing the state you are trying to prepare. For example, you may have some velocity selection, and that only works sometimes. So, so we may have some lights on here that flash, and that means so we have so generally we have some outcomes over here. And imagine we have, for example, two outcomes, outcome one and outcome two. We're interested in calculating the joint probability for this circuit. Maybe over here we have some outcomes as well. Let's call this A. So that's the probability that this thing flashes and, say, this thing flashes, the joint probability. Okay, that's maybe we associate this outcome with the preparation A. So since this thing may or may not flash, that the total probability associated with the preparation when you see outcome A is already less than one. And if you're calculating the joint probability, you want to be sure to keep that in your state. Otherwise, you don't capture it. So then you can calculate the state as the total probability can be calculated as the trace of potentially subnormalized state times associated with this times the positive operator associated with that. And this will give you the joint probability. I think people in quantum theory often, the reason they use normalized states is because they want to calculate the conditional probability. What's the probability that conditioned on this preparation being successful, I see this, the appropriate outcome over here. And that's fine, except that it means you have to normalize this state, which is nonlinear. Whereas if you calculate the joint probability, you don't have to normalize, you don't have to do this nonlinear thing. You can always use joint probabilities to extract conditional probabilities afterwards, just using the normal rules of probability. But it seems to me that it makes more sense to do that afterwards rather than incorporating it into the definition of the state space, because this is a very natural thing, that this preparation may be unsuccessful. And so, yeah, I think computation also, and I think also one gains a deeper understanding of the physics when you understand that it can just be linear. All the calculations can be linear involving states and operators and so on. And then only afterwards do you you use probability theory to get conditional probabilities if that's what you want. So it's very good to have this whole cone, because it corresponds to the cases where you may not successfully prepare a system. So this is one example. Another example is even if you have a deterministic preparation, so this is always a successful preparation, maybe you now send it for a transformation. And this one has some lights on it. So now the state associated with this thing, a certain outcome here, if you take this as a preparation, then it may not always be successful. And so it's good to represent this by a state which is inside the cone, like away from the top of the cone. So that's the reason I think we shouldn't jump to normalized states. It just makes our calculations simpler, and it reveals the linear structure that's there in quantum theory. It's nice to keep things linear as much as you can. And this whole framework I just showed you, at the top, everything is linear in each operator. But if you were trying to calculate conditional probabilities rather than joint, then it wouldn't look so linear, and it would become a bit messy. Okay. Any more questions on this before I? So I had two more subjects that I was going to discuss, but I'll just mention them. So the first one is the problem of quantum gravity. I think I've mentioned before that I think really getting to the next fundamental theory may well be necessary to understand the measurement problem. At the very least, we should be cautious of accepting any interpretations of quantum theory as actual fact at this stage in the development of physics, since we don't have a theory of quantum gravity. The sort of approach I've outlined in the last few lectures suggests a possible way of going to quantum gravity. So this is the idea of formulating general probabilistic theories. However, the particular framework I showed you is probably going to be insufficient, because there the causal structure is fixed in advance. So when you draw a particular circuit with particular wires between particular boxes, whereas general relativity has a dynamical causal structure, so it seems like this approach is inappropriate. And so one can think about trying to develop more general probability theories, more general frameworks that might be suitable for a theory of quantum gravity. So some of my own research is based on that approach, and other people have started thinking in these terms recently. So that was the one subject. And then the other subject is there's a very healthy relationship between quantum foundations and quantum information. Maybe I should just draw one picture. Over here, you know, quantum foundations were really interested in this fundamental. One might even say metaphysical questions. And over here, we're interested in rather more practical issues. I mean, I think so far no one's really developed practical applications, but certainly the ideas are much more practical. But there's often a very close relationship between these two fields. So perhaps the earliest example is David Deutsch, who believes Manuel's interpretation, and this motivated him to think about using quantum theory to set up something like computation in parallel. So really, he was motivated by Manuel's interpretation to essentially invent the field of quantum computing. there's applications of Bell's theorem. So Bell's theorem, which was invented to discuss a very metaphysical question of whether it's possible to have a local hidden variable model. But there's an application of Bell's theorem to communication complexity. So this is the idea of two people each have some information, but they want to calculate some joint function of that information. And so the question is, how much do they have to communicate with each other to establish the value of the function? And it turns out that you can get communication complexity reduction if you have previously shared entanglement. And there you're using Bell's theorem. So it's a very practical application of these very fundamental ideas. And more recently, there's been the development of device-independent quantum cryptography, so the idea there is that you want to do cryptography in such a way that you don't rely on believing that your devices work in some particular way. So they may not even work according to quantum theory. Or maybe you don't fully trust the person who gave you those devices. But nevertheless, you want to do cryptography. And you can show that if you can get a violation of Bell's inequality, and you assume that no signaling faster than light is possible, then you can still do cryptography. So this is using Bell's theorem to do quantum cryptography in a device-independent way. So there are many, all the examples I gave you were in this direction, but I think there's also many influences in the other direction. So all the work on rederiving quantum theory recently has been inspired by ideas coming from quantum information. So there's a very rich connection between those two fields. Indeed, if anyone wants to pursue a career in quantum foundations, then it's always a good idea, if you actually care about having a salary at the end of it, to think about some quantum information problems as well. It's also a good idea to take very cautiously the idea of pursuing a career in quantum foundations. It's a very difficult subject to get a job in. I think that's a good place to stop the course. Thank you.